I'm Dwayne Scribner, and this is Five Smooth Stones, Happily Ever After? Which Charlie Mays didn't quite read in the right way, but I hope on the program you all notice the question mark, because it's important. I've had discussions with several of you along the side about Five Smooth Stones this week, and I really appreciate the insights that those brought. You see, some of those will show up today. And what we're going to try to do is to relate, take a good look at Five Smooth Stones and what this creation appears to suggest to us that might be helpful as we think about living the politics of hope. I have to begin, however, with a very important announcement, and that is that we have a significant ethical and moral question in front of us as we approach this discussion. There are some people who haven't completed reading Five Smooth Stones and don't know how it comes out. 2 weeks ago, I faced right up to that when I introduced the book, and I just told everybody what happens at the end. And I'm not going to do that. I decided not to do that again based on the reaction. So while I still think that knowing the outcome of this book actually heightens the reading experience of it, that's what my head tells me, my gut tells me that I need to have more respect for the differing theologies of novel reading. So I want to ask those of you who have completed the book, either during this week or in the past, to support the wishes of those who are still part of the way through those 930 pages, or maybe haven't even started it at all. And the fact is, if you haven't started it at all, there are some copies still available in the bookstore, and it's a book that can sustain you for a fairly long period of time, as some people already know. So we're going to have two discussions today. We're going to have discussion number one, without dealing with the ending of the book. And then we're going to excuse those who don't want to have the end of the book spoiled for them. And if there are some of you who would like to talk about the ending of the book, which I think is very significant to the whole idea of living the politics of hope as well, we'll just stay a few minutes more. I mean, I'll stay a few minutes more, and you can stay if you like, and be late to and go to the second setting for lunch. And then the people who didn't get in on that part of the discussion can order the tape, and they'll be able to get through it. Or more likely, and probably just as effectively, if the book does for you what it really should, you really won't need that discussion. You'll find that you can function very well without it. And if some of you are going out on the boat and don't want to stay around, we'll talk about it on the boat or something like that. But really, the whole of the book is important. It is, after all, something that someone has put together very carefully. And we will the final truths come out of reading, out of finishing the whole book and thinking about it. So I just want to ask those of you who are ahead and have completed the book to exercise restraint and not spoil the book for the others. By the way, you don't need to have completed it. You don't even need to have started it, I hope, to get something out of this discussion. Is there anybody who has any questions about how we're going to proceed on that? Okay. I'm going to spend just about 5 or 6 minutes in talking about the discussion. A little introduction to perspective. And then I hope that those of you who have read, however far you have read, are going to find it possible to carry on the discussion from there on with a little help from me. As what I would like to have us think about today as we talk about this book is really four levels of the question that's the title of this session, Happily Ever After? That's typically that's typically something that you ask about romances, and last week or 2 weeks ago I called this discussion Love Stories as Perspective. But there's more. Happily Ever After is a different kind of question. It's quite deliberately chosen. And I think there are four levels at which we can look at it. One is the love story, of course. One of the problems with the love story is that it really matures very late in the book. And so many of you will not be at a point where you will have a strong sense of what happens with that. The love story, however, is not just David, or it is David and Sarah, but it's not just as a personal kind of thing between them. But I'd like to have us think about it today as also as related to overcoming the barriers between the races, as well as developing the commitment between two people, which is so important to David's development as a character, as his growth. The other three levels, the other three areas, are that can you see Happily Ever After when you look at the insights this book provides into the black experience and into the civil rights movement as a setting? That's perhaps the easiest level to look at the book on, because it immediately gets you into some backgrounding on what it is to be black, and in a position where you can ask the question, you know, what would you think the future holds based on the sense of that you get out of this book. Also, some insights into the civil rights movement. Again, the civil rights movement comes into this book very late. Hopefully, though, you may have been helped somewhat by seeing the Martin Luther King movie. So that's a second level, the love story, and then this. Third level is a translation of that background experience into the interactions among the key characters and between them and their environments. And we're actually going to do a little exercise of trying to think about the characters and their relationship to each other based on however far you are into the book. That is always, in a work of fiction, the key to the message, whatever it is, of the book. And finally, what is the essence of the book, in my judgment at least, is the development of David Champlin as a person in this book. And you'll see what that is, I hope, very quickly. Now, any one of these four areas is, with this book, is probably worth talking about for at least an hour and maybe several. We're going to try to deal with all four of them in the next 45 minutes. And I want to rely very heavily on those of you who are well into the book to deal with those issues. We're going to see what insights they provided you into the black experience and the civil rights movement, into that interaction among characters, into the development of David Champlin as a person and a hero of this book, and into the love story. The question, Happily Ever After, should be much in our minds in all four of these areas. And finally, we'll want to keep our attention on the theme for Holden this summer, Living the Politics of Hope. See what, in what way this book informs that question. Now let's just run a quick little check. How many people have finished the book who are here? We've got two. Okay. How many people have gotten past the death of little Joe and David's decision to go into the civil rights movement? How many of you are that far? Okay, so we're only one more. We have only three people who are that far. Okay. And how many people have got David out of law school? About one more. All right. Okay. That's good. We'll be operating with some of the early parts of the book, very significantly. That's all right. So let us get into it. Let's begin with the looking at the insights into the black experience and the civil rights movement. This, as I said, is maybe the easiest thing, but it also, for the civil rights movement, may require being well along in the book for part of it. But let's give it a try. Five Smooth Stones is a book which is set in New Orleans with a black boy, a baby at the beginning, who, as we was mentioned in the previous discussion we had, may be marked, chosen, and so identified as in some way. And it is, if you remember the first passage or two that we looked at together, he lives in a world which is clearly oppressed, and that is the mood that we establish at the beginning. Just to mention a couple of things at the beginning of the book, there are several little sections on learning what it is like to learn to be black. There is a passage describing the death of David's great-grandfather, David Champlin I, Little Joe's father, on a bonfire, as it's put. It's something that turns out to be very important later in the book. Then David moves into the white world of a college. As you have read into this book and into some of the detail that is there, what sense have you been able to get about what it is like, what it was like to be black, to transfer from this specific experience into what it was like to be a part of that black society in that time? Are there things that come out strongly based on your experience with the book?
I just like to ask a question reflecting on that. To me, it was such an oppressive situation and so overwhelming. Could you comment a little about our authoress and how she would have been able to gain the sense of...
I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea. I know no more about the author than you find in the back of the book.
Okay. Yes, she just did such a good job. I mean, I assume this is fairly accurate from other things I've read so far. And it was just so real in such a personal way, and I think often you have to live it through the eyes of one person to understand. And I think this is probably one of the clearest pictures I've ever had of what it might be like personally.
Well, it's clearly, I think, one of the reasons the book sold so well when it came out was that it did provide people with almost a living. Back at the beginning of the discussion, I talked a little bit about, you know, you've got the gut and the head in looking at this thing, the feeling part of it, and it really does get you into that.
One thing that really struck me is that the race issue was just all prevalent. It was just prevalent throughout every movement, every thought, every action, it was just always there for him. It was something he could never relax and forget about.
It was just as if he almost had to always move with a mask on. And whether or not he could take that mask off was really a question as to whether or not that the mask of trust, whether you could really let that down. And it was so rare that he could.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you find coming out of that is something about trust. And I just wonder if we couldn't explore that just for a minute or two a little bit further. Do you find trust in this book? Where?
A lot of trust between him and his grandfather and
right.
his professor.
Right.
To start with.
Right. Later on with Brad Willett. He can move, even though Brad is northern and there are differences between them, he can move a little later on to depend on him. Right? Where else do you find it?
He always has the trust of his faith, which he keeps going back to, at least as far as I am to this point. And I'm not sure if it's a belief or it just makes him feel good.
All right,
it's a very intuitive thing. It is not an intellectual thing.
All right.
That, needs a vitamin.
That's right. There's the faith is a very, very significant part of that. There is a little later on, much further on in the book, there's a passage in which there's a place in which David is playing music on the piano just before the big confrontation at Keensville, in this little town in the south, which is one of the tragic scenes in the book. And there's a discussion there of the way in which what had been laments, songs of lament, are now quite thrillingly, apparently, to David, at least that's the sense I get from reading it, are now turned into songs of hope because of what is happening. And then, of course, the thing comes crashing down in a couple of pages to some extent. But So that faith thing is extremely important. All right, there's another.
Back to the trust. I think the trust came in spite of David. Like his trust with Chuck Martin, you know, it was something that came not because he was trying for it, you know, it was in spite of it.
All right, David is white. I mean, Chuck is white. And there's a real difference there. There is, one of the big differences in trust is I think you look at David and this whole collection of people around him, and you get a very strong feeling that within the black community, generally there in this book, there is great trust. You move outside of that, then it becomes more a one-on-one thing. Then it has to be proved. But it's almost as if there is an immediate acceptance of community at the first level that provides David with a good deal of strength and its faith and so on. But even the faith is not something that you really can share without asking questions with white people. And when you say that it's oppressive, just, you know, terribly oppressive, and overwhelming and dominating, that's all part of the same thing. It is a separate society, and one which is not one where there's not much movement between them. All right. I'd just like to do one little piece that I think just remind you of one little place that I think illustrates that. This is on page 91. And David is talking, they're talking about going to college. And Graham, that is little Joe, has a, well, how does he feel about David's going to college?
Yes, no.
All right, he's very ambivalent, fairly negative. He really thinks that that's going to destroy David, or has a fear that it will. And he says, you've been living with a white world all your life, but you ain't been living in it. They's a difference. We lives in one world, they lives in another. Never could go all the way with your Graham, not wanting you to even have to work for him. Hell, that don't make no sense at all. They got all the money, all the jobs, all the power. Thing is, though, you moving right into their world, and that's something they don't want, no how. How many colored they got there in that college? The prof says maybe a dozen or more. That's in all classes. They want more, and the prof says there's no segregation, not in the dormitories or the classes or even in the town. You colored boys going to look like a bunch of lonesome fleas floating in a pan of milk. How many head of kids they got there all told? Maybe a couple of thousand. Gramp was quiet for a moment and then elaborately casual. They got women's up there? It's coeducational. You ain't answered my question. It means they've got girl students too. Suddenly little Joe Champlin's voice sharpened. You steer clear, do you hear? And David gave an involuntary start at the quickness of that. Said, my gosh, Gramp, did I say I wouldn't? Don't get so excited. It's no good. That's trust. That's the level at which they operate and the separateness of those societies. All right.
I heard that same argument given by good Lutheran parents whose children were going to go off to the state university, though, rather than to the Lutheran school.
Explore that a little bit.
Okay. You're going out there with all those people who aren't like us, meaning non-Christian. And you know they've got co-ed dorms and the boys are in the girls' bathroom. And haven't you heard it?
Oh, yeah. 25 years ago. I went to a state university in a town that had a Lutheran college right across the street.
And they knew you were doing.
Yeah, well, they did. They did. Fortunately, I wasn't Lutheran, so I didn't have to. But there's a real point there, I think.
It's
trust. Now, what's the difference, do you think, between those two things? Between what you just mentioned and the kind of thing you see here?
Well, there's a real degree of danger for David in this situation, whereas, you know, you might have your ideals bent a little bit, but probably there are people who are obsessed with.
And they're probably not going to kill you.
Right.
There's a lot more visibility between black and white than between most of them don't wear a button saying I'm Lutheran or I'm Catholic, so that, you know, you can mix without that. But it's very obvious in this.
Well, Joe says later, too, in the book, you know, that you can trust a white man, but not a woman.
And that's a real issue for
science.
All psychological.
All right. For those who have finished, if you were going to pursue this further on into the discussion and are into the civil rights part of it, into insights into the civil rights movement that the book can provide, where do you think they come? Where do you think they are? Either as you remember the book or as you've been reading it right now. I can't remember exactly. I know Joe's finished the book. And who else? Joe, where's the... What did the book say most to you about the civil rights movement?
That it took a lot more courage than I realized to do that. But you mentioned grace last night and told me to think about it. And that there was an obligation on David's part that Reverend Jackson picked up. He got so many breaks along.
Reverend Jackson is the pastor who spoke at little Joe's funeral. And as a result of that speech, David didn't go to Africa. David had a choice, sort of, between going to Africa, becoming a consultant to a black nation, or working with his people. He changed his mind.
In my concept of grace, what he was doing, he was not earning. It had already been given to him. And what he was doing is seeing that he had a debt to pay. And that he set about with a vengeance to pay.
He really went unwilling into the movement. You know, the resistance back and forth throughout the thing is one of the most interesting things about that. And I expect it's generalizable. I've heard that Martin Luther King was read, as a matter of fact, that Martin Luther King was extremely hesitant at the age of 26 to take responsibility for this bus boycott in Montgomery. And you can see why. It could get in the way of a career. It has all those other things. And so he is forced into it. And I would guess that like any of the rest of us through the period of the development of through that 13 months, he must have wondered many times if this was going to be a great success or a great failure. It seemed like it could have probably only be one or the other for him.
It was so frightening. You know, and that's the thing that I don't think we can really understand, that you didn't look a white woman in the face, because you might not do anything and you're dead. Like his great grandpa was unjustly accused and burned to death.
Yesterday, before Mark Harrington left, we were talking with him because he participated in the
right.
South in the movement and was very active in it. And I was telling him, the one thing I really remembered about that time being on the West Coast was the woman from the Midwest who was killed. And he made a very interesting comment because he had worked with those people. And he said, that was really a stupid mistake. She was traveling with a black at night on a highway, a sort of remote highway. So it brings all this really to happen. She was killed. I think the
policy.
There it is.
Right. Anybody else who's gotten that far into it and has some sense of that? One scene in the book, which I hope you'll pay close attention to when you get to with regard to this, is Keynesville. Keynesville is where the confrontation takes place, the big one. All kinds of things happen there. And it is a terribly frightening experience even to read it. I mean, it just, you just get to have some sense of the same thing you see when the troops, or when the city troops from Selma in the film on Martin Luther King come forward to break up the group that wants to march to Montgomery. I don't know if you remember that, but it turns into awful chaos and people rolling on the streets and just kind of a war. That's what happens at Keynesville. It's very similar in some respects. It has some other aspects to it as well. But David has made another decision just prior to being at Keynesville. He had the chance and was all set to go back and work in the movement as a manager and administrator back in the East. And he decided not to. He became, at this point in the story, a leader. He made a little speech. Made a little speech, which would be fun to read, but we won't take the time to do that. And then he did something else. He sat down at the piano with the mob outside, with all of these black people. At the time it was very low. Things weren't going their way, and he began to play the piano. And a little bit there's a drummer behind him, and he does some playing, and then he leaves, and it keeps on. And he talks again about blacks and whites, or that is, he's thinking here about blacks and whites. The songs they were singing now had once been songs of defeat in spite of the triumphant message of their words. They had been songs that invited death as the only way out, called to it, beckoned to it. Then they had been songs that meant freedom would come only when a great chariot came down from heaven and carried them away to rest and release from soul burdens grown too hard to bear, to a place where they would be seemly in the eyes of a colorblind God. Now the songs had a different meaning. Even to the ears of the old people, they had a different meaning. And he goes on. And then he talks about the whites. He knew the people on the other side of the barricades would not hear what he was hearing in the voices that must be coming to them clear and strong. He saw the head of one of the troopers bobbing to the rhythm. and doubted that the man even knew he was doing it. If God had given them the ears to hear the music, and he had not, thought David, what they would be hearing now would send them running for the hills, like a mob running before rising, pursuing floodwaters. Out of the past, out of a gray day when he had stood outside a cemetery in New Orleans, the music he wanted to play came to him, and he finished just a little while, and so on and so on. And then he talks about how the crowd picks up on the stuff. And he says, and then they were not with him, but he with them, walking with them on the highway, walking with the king, marching, marching, marching. And the ache of bruised muscles was gone, the soul-destroying weariness, the burdens of 100 years and 1 million people. And he was walking with them, marching with them, invincible, walking with the king, which is a reference to God. There had been a day in church many years before when a child seated with his grandfather had soared high over the heads of the people to glory land as his grandmother sang. Now the child was marching. It was his own voice cutting into the harmony of others, praise his holy name, and then it was the voice of the unknown man and unknown woman walking with the king. And you get, it goes on. It perhaps in some ways is the most dramatic scene in the book, and I hope you will watch for it. But it communicates something about the civil rights movement, about the movement for those people who were participating in it. The fact that it was a way for them of being able to move beyond where they had been as a community. This is no longer the black community in New Orleans that you find at the beginning of the book. It is a different kind of thing. There's change. And it really gives you a sense of the power of the kind of community and unity that they've been able to put together in the face of the trouble. Well, that's one level of looking at the book, and I hope those of you who still have the rest of the reading to do will watch for it. Second one is the interactions among the characters. 2 weeks ago, we did a little exercise, and people prepared for it in advance. We won't do quite the same thing this time, but we have some characters. One is David. One is Sarah. And some of you obviously are not really into Sarah very far yet, because she comes along later. There's Little Joel. There's, what's his name? Knudsen? Bjarni. He's white. We have to mark.
Well, he's Danish.
He's Danish. I guess he's not really. He's not really white. That's really true. That's the wrong thing to put out there. Right?
He's European.
He's European. We'll put an E there for European. And then there's Chuck.
True.
Travis, just to name another one. Let's just leave it at that for the present time. The question I asked 2 weeks ago was, what matters most to these people in the sense of what's really most important to them, recognizing that we don't have real people here, you know. This is a work of art. What we have are people who have been created in words, and we can assume that what they are is very deliberately and thoughtfully established, and the insights we get into it tell us something about the work itself. What's important? What matters most to David?
Integrity.
All right. Other things that seem to you, based on wherever you are, what you know of David, what you've read of David?
Well, I think the love and trust between him and his grandfather.
Okay.
Family.
Let's call that family. Anything else?
along with that would go the need to sort of pay back to do what this, he's been so lucky to have all these breaks, and he seems to feel the need to.
You have to pay for your luck.
Sort of. Justification.
Learning and progress, you know, he did have this drive to.
Okay. Folks call that growth. Personal, kind of personal growth. In a very much in an academic sense, let us say, at this point. He really wanted to learn and saw it as a mobility kind of thing. Right, let's leave him for the moment. And before we get to Sarah, let's do Little Joe. Little Joe is a fairly clearly static character. You just look at him and what matters to him. Very specifically, David. This is a person, you talk about people who are willing to give their lives. This is a person who did, in fact, devote his whole life to David at this point. All right, what else? Anything else?
Music.
Life hereafter instead of life on earth.
Okay, salvation. And in the personal, religious sense.
And the kind of integrity in his work ethic, too. It's right. Very clearly defined sense of it. Works hard and certain.
Right, works hard. It's the one who says, you know, you got to work for him, you got to earn the money. It's a great find of the $10 in the bar. $20, whatever it was. Okay.
Going ahead and doing the job even when he found out he was only getting 50 cents. You know, that
okay.
That's a real first thing.
For want of something better to call it. I mean, I think it transcends that, but it's kind of work ethic, right? Okay. David, you find a relationship between these two very clearly then. After all, that's the parent-child relationship for all practical purposes. Bjarne comes in early in the book. What matters most to him?
Justice.
All right. It's almost as if Ann Fairbairn might have heard a Walter Stewart's little thing yesterday on the Scandinavian that got a little bit into the sort of sense of social justice that's there. That's if reading this book will show you why that's that way, Walter. Exaggerating.
David also.
David also.
Yeah.
Why did he get into David?
David's his son.
Yeah. Son of his mind.
Right? The son of his mind and almost a symbol of this issue.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Epitomized the best of Bjarne.
So Bjarne just takes it upon himself to make sure that David moves ahead in the world that Bjarne knew he could help him move ahead in. It's that kind of a commitment to David. Seeing that as the route to, on a personal level, to this. One of the questions that has kept coming up about this book is do you think Bjarne saw David as a civil rights leader?
He had that possibility, potentiality of that.
All right. And that, so David includes a great deal of potential.
I would think of potential more in the fact that he could prove to the whites that a black with a decent opportunity could compete and excel.
All right, so Bjarne really had a crusade going on here. He wanted to mold David, to use David to make a point. And, all right. Now, those are people in the background.
Well, we forgot about Little Joe. Bjarne really loved Little Joe.
All right. Little Joe mattered a great deal.
And in fact, I think that when he saw how crushed he was over David's accident, you know, when he was a child, that's when he said, we are going to, together, we are going to make David successful. Give him a chance.
Well, let's just get to Sarah a little bit here.
Commitment.
The basic need to love and be loved.
All right. If you were to take the sense in which we've talked about some things, as whether they're from the head or from the gut, where does Sarah operate?
Yeah.
All right. Very, very quickly you see that.
She's innocent. She's a free spirit.
She's a free spirit. She's innocent. She's naive. Sounds like, what does she sound like?
The opposite of David.
Well, yeah, the opposite, that's right, the opposite of David. Of course, she has a great advantage. She's white, you see. And so she can be naive and innocent and free-spirited, but sounds like something else, too, to me, as I have been unfolded in the last few weeks.
Hopeful.
She's a very hopeful person. And about this. She has, you can call that trust. It's her, it's almost faith. In fact, it probably is faith. She really believes, and this turns out as the story goes on to be very important, she really believes that she and David, she loves David. If she loves David enough and David loves her enough, that they can overcome.
She really feels that there's just no there's no option.
Right. You have to. You have to do that.
That's the way it is.
All right. Anything about Chuck and or Travis that somebody would like to mention very quickly that characterizes them? Chuck is a white who becomes a minister and joins the Civil Rights Movement. He is an activist, a white activist in civil rights, and a pastor.
He has that intuitive sense of justice that kind of belies his culture and his upbringing.
Okay.
His authenticities, yeah.
Where does it come from? You get a very good insight into that, whether this is realistic or not. Where does it come from?
Crack, what is it called, Cracker? He's from the South.
Yes.
What is it, Cracker?
Cracker Barrel?
Is it
Cracker
Barrel?
Crackers.
Just
crackers.
Crackers? Yeah. Right. David is much put off, well, everybody is, every black is much put off, because all they have to do is hear him talk.
Yeah.
And that's really another kind of insight into the background. But he has it. But where does he get his commitment from?
His father, the shame of his father not saving the situation.
All right, here's
his relationship with his friend.
All right, he had a black friend as a child.
Yes,
ended up very tragically.
But it's almost as if he
guilt
had
trip
within him, you know, this very special quality, and this just triggered it.
Right.
But it might not have had the same reaction in someone else, his gift.
All right, he is very important here as a catalyst, but more than that, he has a... He may have gotten into what he got into because of guilt, but by the time this book is over, he has gone far beyond that. He is operating on an entirely different sort of level. And Travis is the well-bred, wealthy, mixed blood.
He's the bridge.
Huh?
He's the bridge.
Right. He belongs to the group of blacks who have always been northern. Who've always been able to cross. Who've always been able to cross over between those communities as they know them. But you notice he stays out of the South. He stays out of the South. All right. Let me just say something about this. One of the things that happens in this book is that David at the beginning of the book and David at the end of the book are very different people.
there is something happens to David in the process, and it relates to the decisions he makes. David, this book has got to be about David, because for no other reason than that David is the person who grows. And a good deal of that growth comes after places where most of you are in the book. So, but you're going to see it. And it comes out of one of the places you see it occur is here. Sarah doesn't change much. Sarah is just relentless. I mean, she gives up. She decides David hasn't got it. And what it is that David hasn't got is
courage.
Or
maturity.
Faith. That there's too big a gulf between them that she doesn't see as a racial one. And of course, David would see it as coming out of the racial difference. But he can't make the commitment. You know, he can't make the commitment to go. And it goes right up to the last part of the book where at the point where Sarah is pregnant, where they do marry and Sarah is pregnant, there's an argument. there's an argument. She hopes it's a boy. David doesn't want it to be a boy. And there's a very specific reason for that, which has been mentioned already in the discussion. David is still not at the point where he thinks that a black man can live a humane life. You'll watch that happen. But the dynamic between them is one of Sarah chipping away at David, helping him grow. Little Joe, helping him grow. Yarny, helping him grow. Sure does. David is a hard case. David is a hard case, and that brings us to the issue of the development of David as a person. And we've already talked about some of the things that you notice about David. The deep faith, commitment, and understanding of his people and the trust for them. His inability to trust the whites, which is one of the things that happens. He finds selected white people he can trust. And of course he finds that there are some you can't trust. He has some very brutal experiences later in the book. We see him developing in the choices he makes between going to Africa and the movement. Why did he even consider going to Africa? Looking back at David at the beginning of the book, why would you think he might choose, as a very talented, highly educated Harvard lawyer, to go to Africa, which Sarah was quite willing to have him do, Brad Willis, who isn't even on this list, encouraged him to do? Why would he do that instead of responding to the needs of his people?
Safe territory.
All right, it's safe. It's safe. He can do something for his people on another level that doesn't put him in the real environment of risk. It's a much less risky kind of thing. It's so clearly drawn that the only conclusion you can come to about the author is that what she is doing is posing that as an issue. And frankly, I think it's an issue that's been posed around Holden Village over the last couple of weeks. The question of, you know, do you get into an issue, a significant issue, on the level of rational discussion of it and talking about it and doing it, or do you get in there where the action is and where something is happening on an immediate level? What somebody in one of the discussions yesterday called pragmatic. I guess maybe that was Judy Madison.
But it's not just that. It's, if he had gone to Africa, he would have been, you know, in the spotlight, glorified, famous, or, you know, looked up to.
Right. And he obviously has a desire for that.
He
pretty cerebral.
You see it later on at Keynesville. He really enjoys, a couple of places, he really enjoys making the speech and being well received and being able to move people. It's the same kind of thing, and he hopes to satisfy that. All right, but he doesn't do that. All right, it's in spite of him almost that he doesn't do it. We see him as somebody who is unable to commit to Sarah. But we see him again who finally, as someone who finally accepts the necessity of going into the movement. Each time it's triggered by an awful event. In one case, Little Joe's death. Not the fact that Little Joe died, but how he died. And then a whole series of other things. All right. I want to suggest to you in the few minutes that we have left that there really is something very much related to the kinds of discussions that have been going on here in a Lutheran Christian environment that permeates the development of David. Joel has already suggested it. And David had faith, you know, not maybe quite as much as he needed finally to go, but he found himself in a situation. There is finally in David, way toward the end of the book, almost a complete comfort with where he is. He becomes willing to live, to accept what it is that might happen to him, wherever it is. He gets the courage, in other words, on a personal basis. That is not romantic, because as I mentioned earlier, he still doesn't think of it as a world in which he wants to raise a son. But he might be willing to raise a mixed blood daughter, you know, which is sort of a compromise step forward. But for his own, for himself, on a personal basis, he simply accepts where he is. He's been in jail. A lot of things happened to him along the way. He sees his fellow leaders in the movement shot down. He sees the brutality and all the rest of it, and he stays and he works. He's tempted to move away. It goes from being tempted to go into the movement, backing away, to being tempted to go out of the movement and staying in. And in the sense that it's been discussed around here, it is almost as if David finally has to learn to accept the freedom that grace provides to him. It takes him almost all the book to sort of reach that liberated state that is supposed to come from being a Christian. And so, in a sense, it's almost as if, at least it seems to me it is. I never thought of this before I came to Holden Village. But it seems to me that we have here, and I suspect deliberately, a sense of that growing maturity and so on, not just in an ordinary sense, but in the Christian sense. There's a love story here, and we are at the end of discussion one. The question comes, is it happily ever after in any one of these areas that we've been talking about? I've deliberately stayed out of the love story specifically, but I think you've gotten a little flavor of it. Because I think you need to read it to really see it. Is it happily ever after? Is this a book that seems to you, based on where you are and where this discussion has gone, is happily ever after?
I think he was able to integrate himself personally the way you're describing it to you.
All right. Not necessarily for black people. Right. Not necessarily for the David and Sarah relationship. Not necessarily in the sense of a love story. but there is hope, at least. There's just no doubt, I think, of the sense of hope that comes in this book. And I say that, I'm going to say that even after we have discussion of part two, I mean discussion two, that includes the ending. It looks as if it will be, as we approach the end of the book, it looks very much as if it will be as Sarah sees it, that they can make it, that David can make it. And Sarah's naive commitment and hope and trust and simply faith in their power to do this together. If they can, you know, if they can just work at it together, she knows that it will occur. And I would just like to end this part of the session with an entirely different sort of thing. A couple of you have heard, but I think the rest of you probably haven't, which is a folk song. Or rather, a song written by a folk singer that suggests to me a good deal of the theme that is really in Five Smooth Stones. And I'm just, it's at the bottom there, it's called Turning Toward the Morning, and there's a chorus there which don't hesitate to join in if you'd like to. It's a very captivating chorus.
Talk about the end of the book.
Created a little controversy because Molly wanted to stay and talk, and Vera has to eat the minutes.
Well, she's got to read to finish reading the book, doesn't she? What do you think? What do you think the significant about the ending of the book in light of what we just said?
I suppose, really, as an art form, it couldn't have ended any other way.
Why not?
Because he got so many breaks all the way through. Then it would have been just kind of an inconsequential book, kind of a fairy tale. Everything worked out for David and Sarah, and they have a happy family, and he ends up making a bundle in law after completing his time in the trenches.
All right. And here you have, at the end of the book, a young widow with a new baby who's part black. And is there anything hopeful about that at all?
Yeah, his name's David. No. And that even though, you know, the thing is, I was just thinking about, things really hadn't changed from his great-grandfather's time. He was killed at the same spot by the same senseless, just man, you know, for the wrong reason. Yet, they had moved a tremendous distance. He could choose to die for his people, whereas the first David couldn't. And if that had taken only those generations, you know, what was the possibility for the next
day? All right, that's just great insight, Joe. I think that's
that is right where it's going. And as a matter of fact, I think you can argue on a symbolic level, at least, that David is not dead. That, in fact, one of the great things about this story, and the thing you have to kind of have to accept, is that David still lives, because he lives in Sarah. You know, what has happened is that they have been able to do that. And so Sarah can do what it took both David and Sarah to do before, or would have taken both David and Sarah to do. And since that is a bridge across black and white, you know, that is just a very powerful sort of thing. It's very romantic, actually, to think that could happen.
I was just thinking about his limp, you know, and even though for all of David's accomplishments, he was still broken and flawed.
That's right.
He had that limp, and there seemed to be a spirit that the new David not only was educated and had potential, but he wouldn't have that limp.
Bring the first or second lunch.
Huh? We're still on. All right. I think that's right.
And
so there's just, it's like David 1, David 2, David 3, and you just, it's a world difference. It's not only a difference, there's much more of a difference in the world in which the third David is born compared to the world in which the second David was born than there is between the world in which the first David, or the second David was born, and the world in which his great-grandfather was born.
But third David would not turn his back on it. Sarah wouldn't allow, just like little Joe didn't allow David to forget where he's from, the third David would know whose he was, and so he would carry on.
Yeah, even though, you know, you don't get any sense that Sarah is religious in the sense that David was. That never comes up in the whole, that issue never comes up in the whole sense. In the whole thing. Nevertheless, there is a transfer of something from David to Sarah that makes this thing possibly work down the road. And when I read the book this last time and got through the thing, and all of a sudden there I am, and I think, you know, this isn't tragedy. This is hopeful. It really is. That last little chapter where she is holding the baby and it goes on, it's just a tremendously hopeful ending.
And her response to that woman's call from the south, you know, saying, you know, we got it, your husband's dead, how's that make you feel? Now, did not destroy her or really make her bitter. She went nuts for a while. But it's somehow that good has, there is hope that good can triumph in spite of the massive evil that we face.
That's the politics of hope.
Yeah.
Living the politics of hope. It's like, well, thank you. Thank you for finishing the book so we could have a rounded out discussion that generations of the future might hear on this tape.
Well, I couldn't do otherwise.
Right.